Hey
Hey,
everyone,
Bethany.
it is October 28th again. Actually, this is the second episode we've been recording today, and it's going to be called episode 167. I'm your host, Casey Cangelosi, and we've got two of our usuals today. Laurel Black is here,
Hi.
and Ben Charles is here. Hey, Ben.
Everybody.
Well, we have to just dive right in, I think, because this is one of those episodes where we got one of those historic living percussionists of the day. And it's so funny, our listeners often say, "Give me people I've never heard about," and they often say, "Give me people I've heard about that I need all this good information on." And this is definitely a person that is a very important person to what percussion is today and why percussion is the way it is. And he just has I don't even know what to say, because there's just so much that Bob Van Slice has done for what marimba is specifically today, but also what contemporary percussion is. And just what we have now is hugely in part to Bob Van Slice. And I'll just leave it at that. So,
And I
hey.
think we should have come up with a stat for this. Like, I think if you just look at our previous guest roster and how many of our previous guests have been Bob Van Slice students, I think that
Right.
really attests to the.
Especially
Right,
they'll
well,
be out there practicing, not talking on.
right, yeah, just earlier today we just had one. Yeah, Dimitri, of course, was one also. So yeah, we've mentioned his name just many times over the years we've had the show. So hey, so great to have you, and welcome, Bob Van Slice.
Thank you ever so much for inviting me. It's lovely to be with you and have a chance to chat. Your very kind words are both appreciated and overblown. I wish I really was as good as what you just described, but I'll start trying harder tomorrow.
That's a great way to be. Ben, we started us off with a question. We have a bunch of Facebook questions, and from what I know of Mr. Van Slice, he can talk just extensively on these things. I mean that in a good way, so I think we better just start right off. Would you mind?
I think Laurel had the question.
Oh, thank you.
I got him. Yeah, so this question comes from Connor Mulford, and he would like to know, what are the biggest differences you find between a teacher and a performer? And is it possible to be only one, or is it necessary to be both?
My gracious. I thought we would start with an easy question and warm up a little bit. That's a fastball right over the center of the plate. To be both. I'm not so good, Laurel, at speaking in the hypothetical about things. I can really only speak in my own personal experience. And so I kind of would answer the gentleman's question from my own life experience. I think that being both has kind of merged into one. There's very rarely ever felt like a difference in my own musical life between my teaching and my playing. I kind of fell into teaching very young, and my first orchestral job was in Cape Town in South Africa as the timpanist of the Cape Town Symphony, and I was fortunate enough to teach at the University of Cape Town while I was there. And it all kind of happened enough by accident, if you will, that I had never really had time to sit back from my own experience studying with Mr. Duff and with Mrs. Abe and with Mike Rosen and all these people I had the privilege of being guided by, to really think about the bigger pictures of what it meant to be a player and what it meant to be an educator at the same time. I just kind of was a young guy out there playing, trying to figure out how to guide some people who were asking me to help them learn to play as organically as I could learn to do that. So I'd love to tell you that there's some big, incredible hocus pocus behind how I started my pedagogical career. I always want to call all those people back who studied with me in the first 5 years and say, I actually know how to do this now. If you want to come back, the lessons were a lot better. But I think that one just informs the other. And I think that some of the greatest players who I know were a little bit less adept at explaining something to someone and incredibly good at showing things to them. Some of the people who I know who are extraordinarily articulate and really great with verbiage may not necessarily have as good a soft snare drum roll as that other guy had, and everything kind of in between. And so, and my own playing and teaching have evolved so much. When I was in super shape and I was concertizing all the time until late my late 30s, a lot of my own teaching was done by example. It was a little bit sort of Tarzan teaching, you know, sort of here you sit there, listen to this and try to make it sound like that, if you will. And as I began to take myself more and more off the stage, and it's been now a number of seasons that I don't concertize at all anymore, that my verbal communication with the student, it becomes more important than it was when I was playing. I do think it's possible to be one without the other. And I think that it's also another animal when you've got both happening at the same time. I mean, you can think of great examples of some of these things. I mean, look at Steve Schick, who is, you know, a pal of mine and a hero of mine and to everybody else who owns a stick bag, right? And what an incredibly phenomenal player. And you could probably learn from Steve for 4 years in college and never have him open his mouth, just sitting there gawking at his fantastic playing. Or you could also learn from that guy for 4 years just listening to him talk because he's a virtuoso with language. And so I think that it's possible to do both. A lot of the people whose pedagogy I admire and people who've been a big influence on me have really kind of been both simultaneously. I think that I learned as much as I ever learned from both Mr. Duff and Mrs. Abe from just simply having the privilege to be up close to them and hear these magnificent people play. And, you know, Cloy Duff never needed to explain anything to me. It was just, here, Cloy, there are my mallets. Nail this to the wall for me, please, and I'll do everything I can to hopefully sound one quarter that good. And I mean, it was just as simple as you can be. And I do think what a pedagogue is becoming now becomes much more challenging. Is, you know, once in a while I'll laugh. Mike Burritt is not only a colleague of mine, but, you know, somebody I have great admiration for. And Mike and I are on the phone once in a while when, you know, our students are in the finals together and for some college search or something like that. And we'll laugh to each other. He'll say to me, Vance Eiske, do you have half the skills in that job description? I said, no, Mike, in that job description of what they're looking for to teach at the University of I don't know what these days, if you put my resume and your resume together, it covers 2/3 of what this kid's supposed to be able to do, right, for a $40,000 a year job. And it's just completely ridiculous of what the marketplace is trying to define as the future pedagogue. And we just have to be really careful. I mean, let's just be serious. When you look at some of these job descriptions, Laura, who can do that? And I think that we just need to make sure that everybody keeps their feet on the ground as to what the expectations of the modern percussionist and these young folks who are 20 to 30 now, what we're asking them to be able to do.
Oh, I've seen some just crazy ones literally basically run the whole department. You know, I mean, I've literally seen those descriptions. And
well, but Casey, aren't we tired of seeing the ones that look like you need to have been in the Berlin Philharmonic for 10 years? I hope that you were one of the founders of Eighth Blackbird. If you've had a solo career for 20 years, and I hope you taught at Juilliard. And it's just, and by the way, can you run the African drumming ensemble? And
yeah.
I mean, does anybody know anybody like that?
No.
And I think that what we're going to do is we're going to turn a lot of people into jacks of all trades and masters of none. Mm-hmm. And in that, to fulfill what this modern definition is of a percussionist, everybody needs to have a skin deep knowledge of way too many things. That's why I've always been a great believer in specialized teaching and why I've always had a team around me wherever I teach. And that I just, you know, a great ear, nose, and throat guy is not somebody I want operating on my knee. And that doesn't mean that your ear, nose, and throat guy is not a really fine physician. It just means that's not his specialty. Right. And so I have the privilege of Curtis and teaching in a team, and I have a bit of a team around me at Peabody. And I believe that that's one of the ways to skin this cat rather than trying to ask some one individual to be able to do all those things.
I heard Alejandro Vignal make this remark that Bob said something along the lines of, all of my students play better than me, and I expect them to because the resources they had available when they were 16 to 18 years old are so much better than anything, obviously, that you had when you were a student.
My friend, I think there's a really difference between the phenomenon we have in our culture today, which is what I call false humility, is let me humble myself here and in a silly manner. I think that's also just ridiculous. My humility about these kids playing better than me is not just pretty talk. I mean, Jihei and Jisoo and Svet and Sam Ohm and some of these guys, they don't play better than me. They play a lot better than me. And I'm rather proud of that. I had my hand in that happening. I don't take complete credit of any way, shape, or form or fashion of that, but I'm thrilled out of my mind that that's happening. And if that isn't happening, then everybody who's doing the job that I do every day isn't getting it right. And I'm thrilled out of my mind to see people. I mean, look what Jihei did. She shot a great big hole in the adage that playing wrong notes on the marimba is just part of being a marimba player. Well, then Jihei Jung came around, and then there went that, you know? And, yeah, exactly. Yeah, try sitting in the studio when she's 19 years old and watch her play Velocities without a single wrong note or even close to one. And then you're thinking for 8 minutes, what are you going to say, Van Zeiss, huh? What are you going to say at the end of this? But isn't it thrilling to see evolution happen in front of us and know that maybe you had a small hand in making that happen? So yeah, I have said to Alejandro and any number of people that a lot of my students play better than me. I know perfectly well who I am, what my level of playing is, and I'm proud of the contribution I made, and listen to my records and you decide if they're good, bad, or indifferent. That's for someone else to decide. But that we're sitting with a generation of people who play. I sit in these concerts of the collective now just thinking, this was the whole point of the last 3.5 decades, mm-hmm. was to arrive to a place to where 6 percussionists play the level that a great string quartet does. And so, no, I had a really positive outlook on what's about to happen in the next generation of percussion players.
Ben, did you have something, Sil?
I have so many things to ask about. I guess I'll start with the one that probably anyone that's listened before can predict. One of my favorite, and I think probably all of our favorite percussionists and just musicians in general, is Keiko Abe. And I know that you have a very personal experience studying with her. Could you tell us about your studies with Ms. Abe?
Sure. First of all, I think when you talk about Mrs. Abe, you always have to quote Nebojša Zivković. Huh? Nebojša calls her Marimba Mama. Okay. And she's the mother of what we do. And so, you know, none of us could do what we do if it hadn't been for her. And can you try to think for a second, Ben? I mean, you hearken back to 1969 when Minoru Miki writes Time for Marimba, and you think of context. We had the Musser Etudes. We had Mio had written his concerto. We had the Creston Concerto. We were playing Flight of the Bumblebee and transcriptions of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. And then all of a sudden, this lady decides to turn this into an art form. And then all of a sudden, every great composer in Japan is writing very serious music and defining what the voice of our instrument is. How could any human have more effect on their profession? I mean, she is what she is, huh? And so can I speak to Keiko? She's the best. I don't think any of us are even close. I learned so many things from her. Just a second. It was difficult for me to study with her because I did it too young. I was just 20 years old when I was there, and everything she had to teach me was plain and simple above my level. When I was 30, I began to be able to digest what that was. And when I was 40, I could start to see the effect that it had had on me. There's my Keiko Abe answer. The greatest. She's the greatest.
Absolutely, yeah.
She is.
I guess moving along these same lines, we do have another good Facebook question, and it has to do with the repertoire of the marimba specifically. And Will Marinelli always has great questions. He says, what are some of the biggest differences you see in marimba writing today versus when you began your career? And to kick this off, I just want to show you that I have your
record. Oh my God. Casey Cangelosi, where did you get that?
Okay, so like a lot of the good, well, really every percussion record in my office and a lot of cassette tapes, I also applied to Chenoweth. I have Gordon Stout. I have all sorts of Gary Burton. And I have David Friedman. But this is all thanks to my predecessor, Bill Rice. Oh. You know, I've said it on the show many times. Thanks, Bill.
Casey, that's so old. I used to have hair. Look at that photo. Unbelievable.
I know, like, it's great. Isn't that great? I love it. I need to.
I was about 11 when I made that record. Oh my god!
Right.
I'm either flattered or embarrassed or a combination of the two that you just held that old LP of mine up. Oh my god! I was sort of hoping nobody still had one.
playing it, getting it heard is a task, though. It's hard to dig up a record player.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then just keep it on your shelf, pal. It looks better than it sounds. All right. Okay. So the question was, how has marimba writing and playing evolved? Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah, you know, right. Do you know that when Peter Klatzel wrote Dances of Earth and Fire for my Concertgebouw recital, he'd never heard a 5-octave marimba before? When the 2 years that I spent in Cape Town with him, I played on a low F marimba, and I had just gotten my first 5-octave instrument myself when I moved to Europe. And so when I commissioned that piece for a low C marimba, that was something, Casey, that was hypothetical in his ear. He didn't, and everybody spent all these years in classes when I teach that piece to people when I travel all the time, and it's wonderful that all these people play that great piece. But they'll say, you know, just unbelievably insightful how Peter manipulates the sound of the very bottom of the marimba and all the bit. And I said, if that kid thinks that Peter had some really big thing in his ear in his head about that, he was just kind of hoping that it sounded like a low F just better. And and so how has marimba writing evolved? It's evolved so much. And you know, some of the people who don't get enough credit for the evolution and how we write for the marimba are people like Gordon and people like Mike, of marimba players who also write music. I think that especially Gordon in that generation and Mike just a little bit farther along, of guys who were master players who also were composers,
right,
who I think they guided a lot of the decisions that the Jacob Druckmans of the world and all these other people later took, kind of came out of a guy who, you know, was able to get around the marimba himself and compose, beginning to define for us how to write for our instrument. So I think that kind of lost in the shuffle, yeah, James and Alejandro and Jake and all these people, yeah, they all wrote great pieces for us. But the player composers really had their hand in there too. And you can kind of see, especially with Gordon, you can kind of see where he had so much influence on the way people wrote for the marimba after what he did.
Well, you guys have heard me say this on the show several times. I actually said it to someone in just a little Skype interview yesterday. I just agree with that so much. It's like you need people who know the idiosyncrasies of the axe to like explain to the rest of the world how to write it.
That's absolutely.
Well, if I could interject a little funny story. I think I might have told this one before, but the fourth movement of Reflections on the Nature of Water, Gently Swelling, is basically Bill Marsh played the first Mexican dance for Druckmann, and he liked the sort of left-hand vibe of it, and so he sort of ripped the idea off.
You can't help but see the fingerprint of Keiko's writing. You can't help. Alejandro, for example, listened when he was when Khan was first out. He came to Norfolk to teach at our summer festival 1 year, and Jihei was just going to the Linz competition a month after we were getting done, 10, 12 years ago, whatever it was. And he said to me, Bob, I don't know who this lady is. He just was not versed in the marimba. But he said, the first 3 minutes of that piece are the best marimba piece I ever heard in my life and of Japanese children's songs. And he said, who is that? And I said, well, that's the lady who I studied with and blah, 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 blah. But so many of these things that we don't give credit to the player composers for really deserve it. And I think that we have a lot to be proud of from within our own team, not just from the team of composers. Myself, I also credit, when we're talking about my own teachers, to those great composers, though. I think I learned 3/4 of what I know about being a musician from Jake Druckmann and sitting in a room with Peter Klatzel and his music and spending half my life learning James's pieces, et cetera. I think that composers teach us so very much that right now I just am so excited now that every great composer around has either used a marimba in a piece of chamber music, is writing a marimba piece right now, or wouldn't just laugh you off if you asked for one. And it just, that's a long ways from where we were when I was begging James Wood to write Spirit Festival, and I think James finally said yes to me so I wouldn't ask him again. And it just was not on somebody's radar screen. And my gosh, we're there now. And there's all these great people. I mean, who's going to get Mason Bates to write a marimba piece, you know? And who's going to beg John Carigliano into writing a marimba concerto before he retires? And, you know, on and on and on and on. The Kevin Putzes of the world and John Adams of the world. We may not get a yes out of these guys now, but it will at least get a serious consideration because they all know who we are. They know what our instrument is, and they're intrigued by it. And they're impressed by the dedication and the seriousness of purpose of young percussionists. And that's gotten us to a really different place than we used to be at.
Yeah, it's so great to hear you say all this. And it reminds me of the quote, back to the performer percussionist, excuse me, the composer percussionist. Glenn Gould has that little quote that says, the worst thing that happened to the classical piano is that players stopped composing. You know, so it's just, yeah, I mean, it takes those player composers to teach the rest of the world how to write for the,
the instrument. Absolutely. And, you know, very few people know that James Wood was a percussionist. Yeah. And a sort of mostly autodidactic player. And, you know, this was a man who has the same musical gift as Ligeti. I mean, it's just... Right. A gift of the most enormous proportion, and turned himself into a very fine percussionist. And that's why so much of that music really, really sounds. We're in the midst of preparing a village burial right now at Yale. And I haven't revisited that piece in quite a while. And I just got reminded in a rehearsal last night of how magnificent that music is. It's not just good. It's truly magnificent music.
Well, we have a great Facebook question, right, Ben?
Yes, and I'll let Laurel ask the question. Then I had a quick little topic to kind of get us fired off on that. Then I'll let Bob rip on it. So, Laurel, what was the question?
Sorry, I forgot who had him.
Yes, I like how I get double cued from everybody.
Sorry, yeah,
it's double cued. Yeah, it's because everybody's missed me so much. Because
we have missed double you. Cued.
This question comes from Garrett Mendelo. He says, your collaborations with composer James Wood have yielded a number of works for both solo and chamber percussion repertoire. Can you talk about your friendship with him? You've done that a little bit. And then the process of collaborating with him on works such as Elonga, Spirit Festival with Lamentations, and Cloud Polyphonies.
So I'll give the quick little bio first, then we'll get into talking about James Wood some. So James Wood was born in Barton-on-Sea, England on May 27th, 1953. He studied composition, it looks like by my math, at a very young age. I think he was 18 with the famous French composition teacher Nadia Boulanger, who was one of the biggest composition pedagogues of the 20th century. We talked about her a few episodes ago on Doug Perry's episode. Some of her other students include Astor Piazzolla, Quincy Jones, Aaron Copland, Elliot Carter, and Peter Klatzow. So quite a diverse output of students. He studied with her in Paris from 1971 to 1972. After that, he went to study music at Cambridge University as an organ scholar. After graduating at Cambridge, he continued his studies in percussion and conducting at the Royal College of Music from 1975 to 1976. After this, he pursued a two-decade-long triple career as a composer, conductor, and solo percussionist, including a 26-year-long stint as the founding conductor of the New London Chamber Choir. He seems to have quite a bit of choral experience as well as the percussion stuff. He served as the professor of percussion at Darmstadt, and he was the founder and director for the Center for Microtonal Music in London. He's worked closely with leading contemporary composers, including Yannis Xenakis, Mauricio Kagel, Steve Reich, and Karlheinz Stockhausen. And he has 11 solo or chamber works. I think by my math, there were three of them that were specifically written for Bob Van Sice. And then there was one in particular I wanted to mention that was originally written for Steve Schick, Rogo Shanti for solo percussion, which is, I think, a very also in the repertoire of Bob Van Sice and his students. And then I think, like, instead of trying to list out all these pieces, and I'll let Bob do the talking about them individually, I just wanted to read a little note. This was from the program notes for Spirit Festival with Lamentations that I think sums up his music so well and so articulately and artistically. And so Mr. Wood says, it is often said that the very act of striking a percussion instrument constitutes a ritual. Indeed, most percussion instruments have some virtually synonymous, or sorry, have become virtually synonymous with the rituals which they have been associated with for thousands of years. In taking these instruments out of their own context and placing them in a totally new one, I have always felt a strong sense of responsibility to respect their magical and mythological attributes. In acknowledging this responsibility, I have always found there to be sound physical foundations to their traditional mystical functions and associations, and consequently, that they are readily adaptable to new roles within other rituals, both traditionally and imaginary. So that's, like, I think, like I said, just an excellent way to sum up James Wood's music, and I would love to hear Bob Van Sice just go on about this.
Listen, James is, I mean, how can you be more of a real musician than James? I mean, his breadth is more than any musician that I've ever met. And he's unbelievably good at a really lot of things. I think if you met James on an airplane and asked him what he does for a living, he might answer that he's a choral conductor, which the New London Chamber Choir was magnificent beyond compare. But his music for us is at the very base of our repertoire now, and the very base of the language of what everybody makes percussion music into. He's a remarkable person. And I think, Ben, I just sort of jokingly say, but it's really true. I mean, James Wood forgot more about music than I know. I mean, it's just, it's insane what this man's knowledge is and what his skill set is. He just has another side to him that very few people know about. And there's the healthiest part of a human being is a sense of humor. And James has like heaps of it. And he laughs at himself, he laughs with other people, he laughs at things that are funny. And he just...
His own website, his website, it's a picture of him like in a tree, and he says, I have two branches of the website. That's right
it's,
there.
It's for a guy who's a genius, he's unbelievably normal too. And there's a humanity inside of him that I've always adored. I mean, I would love James Ben as a friend, even if he wasn't a musician. I mean, the attraction to me is much wider than just him as a musician. But I don't think that anybody besides Cage and Xenakis have really done what James has done, and an incredible contributor to our art form. And I'm really hoping for a young generation of guys, and now that we see this whole phenomenon of these consortium commissions, you know, some of my guys, some of my young guys just commissioned a piece from him. And I know there are 10 more great percussion pieces inside James. And it's just not a place in my life right now where they're going to come from me and my commissions. I'm walking out the door in the back of the ninth inning right now. And these guys who are still in the second inning of their career, I really hope that we'll draw all the great pieces out of James that he's got to offer to us. It's real music. And I rarely have had an experience playing any piece of music like I do when I was playing Spirit Festival. That's a transcendental piece of music on a level that I'm just not so sure that anybody else could have ever written. And he's a blessing to the world of percussion and music in general.
Wow. Could you actually speak? I know specifically when we had Gwen Deese on quite a while back, she talked about, I think it was Spirit Festival that she played with you. And just the setup for that piece alone, if anyone's unfamiliar, it's a quarter tone marimba. So Bob has his, of course, signature Adams marimba. And then it looks like Adams made another register of quarter tone notes that sit in front of it. And the vibraphone, I believe, also vibraphone and Glock also have quarter tone bars. And so, I mean, just to me, the whole sort of, you know, Harry Parch, make up your own instruments, make up your own whole system of music it's fascinating, but it seems very difficult to conquer. And then this piece is what, 25 minutes long?
Yeah, there's a half hour of that piece. And that's a funny story of when I was used to, in the new music scene in Europe, very many of the same people come across the same people in different cities as the year goes along, different festivals in different countries, and a lot of the same people, you know, run into each other. And I admired James's music and had heard so many pieces and really wanted him to write a piece for me. And when he finally got towards somewhere that was resembling yes, he said, you know, I'd do it for you, but I'm writing only microtonal music at this particular point in my career, and I'll do it if we can write a microtonal piece. And I said, of course, let's get a quarter tone marimba together and let's play ball. And so we're walking back to my hotel room, and my wife says to me, "That was adorable how you just told him that you were going to get an instrument that neither you or I have any idea where it's going to come from. But he's pretty much counting on that's going to happen. So, Mr. Smart Guy, where are you planning to go get a quarter tone marimba?" And that was when I was first working with the Adams guys. And Andre Adams said, "Yeah, sure, I can shoot holes in half steps. You know, I can drape a third keyboard across." And he built us the vibraphone edition, the glockenspiel edition. My part has the quarter tone marimba, any number of a huge setup of cowbells, all microtonal in the same scale as the other ones have. And then you spend 2 hours preparing the piano and tuning the piano to the same scale. So it's a really highly economical piece. It's $10,000 worth of gear. I don't know. And, you know, I can
need 5 custom instruments and you're good to go.
Exactly. And then you only have to practice for 3,000 million hours to learn your part. But Gwenny did play it with me once. I think I've only ever played it once since I came back to the States. And Jihei Jung plays the piece. And so she plays my parts, the only person that I ever coached playing my own part to that piece. And then I don't know whether you guys know about this marvelous player who's down in Australia. There's a lady named Claire Edwardes who's down in Sydney. She's, if that's not a name you're familiar with, she's an absolutely killer player. And Claire has played Spirit Festival. And I think there have been a few other people. I wouldn't be sort of, Pedro's done everything in Portugal. So if Pedro hasn't played it, I'm surprised. But there have been a few people take it on. It's just so darn expensive and so darn cumbersome to make all the instruments for the setup. And the one thing I'd offer while we have a chance to talk to the whole percussion world, if anybody ever really wants to play that piece, I own all the gear. And if anybody wants to do it and they're going to have to say no because they can't get the gear, send me an email and I'd be more than happy to see that piece come to life again. I just so happen to have a quarter tone glockenspiel, a quarter tone marimba, a quarter tone vibraphone. And all that gear is just kind of sitting on a shelf for the moment, waiting for another performance. But
so for those of us keeping score at home, how is the score actually written with the quarter tone music?
It's really not as complicated as it sounds. A quarter sharp, okay, so the pitch between F and F sharp is just written with half of a sharp sign. So it's just one vertical line crossed by one horizontal line. A three-quarter sharp, so the note between F sharp and G, is three vertical lines with one hash across it. And a quarter flat is just a flat sign turned backwards.
Okay, so it is written on traditional, you know, five-line staff.
It is. The way I ended up doing that, when I set up the marimba, it took me forever just to realize where F three quarter sharp was and, you know, where B quarter flat was going to be which one. And I had these giant boards of 30 minutes worth of music to figure out. I thought, you know, I'm going to be about 111 years old by the time I can finally learn this thing. And so I ended up taking James's advice. I ended up highlighting all the microtonal notation, all the alterations that were in my part. And so I could basically read the 12 tone notation and see an alteration coming up in the reading. And so I had a color coding myself of a quarter flat and a quarter sharp, just simply because when the music stand is that far away from you, it's already far enough for somebody who's got my lousy eyes with across two keyboards. Across the third keyboard, it's very hard to read your score. And so having these colored pencils and marking these alterations made it to where, and you eventually, it's like when you learn Demet table music, you think, okay, I've been here for 3 days and I can get through now 12 cymbals and I only know 15 bars. How long is this going to take me? And then the rest of it all happens in 3 more days, you know, so it just takes forever to get used to the language. And if you just hang in there long enough, your brain begins to sort it out. And that's the way it is with microtonal notation. It's really daunting at first. After a little while, your mind begins to be able to see it.
It seems like there'd be great potential with that microtonal glockenspiel for shenanigans in a pit opera that someone would, like good pranks, really good pranks could be. I feel like you could rent it out.
Any number of festivals I've been, people have taken my quarter tone alteration and moved it a half step left or right while they were standing talking to me. The sort of like somebody picks up your E flat and moves it across to the empty space. Right. But I kept my eyes really closely on that one. That one was hard enough to play if it was in the right place, much less if it was in the wrong place.
Wow, excellent. Well, you guys, we're kind of coming to the end here, so I think I'll go ahead while we have Laurel for a free moment and do our quiz. Bob, you are more than welcome. If you know the answers to any of these questions, we do something called speed trivia from the from past episodes of the show, and we keep scores. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I'm going to be nothing more than a spectator on this one, because I'm sure that Laurel's going to nail all these, and I'm going to walk away thinking I know only half of these questions. So I'm going to watch.
That is fine. Okay. Well, if one does draw you out though, and you just feel like you know it, please, you're more than welcome to shout it out, steal some points from these guys.
Do we still type me if we know?
I think so.
Oh, this is the two of them against each other. This is even juicier. All right.
Oh, it's very juicy. It might be the only reason people still listen. It might be. Okay.
Well, I imagine I'm like way behind now because I haven't you're on here.
I know you've missed several episodes, but you're actually tied with Megan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and Ben is down a little bit, but I'm feeling he might be catching up here. So anyway, first question. Regarding the value of competitions, this is way back on episode 6. So regarding the value of competitions, Laurel mentioned the findings of a behavioral psychologist, Alfie Cohn, and Cohn's posture about this type of thing is that competition is a unhealthy and ever-present common denominator in everyday life for all of us. What composer, years far before Cohn, famously agreed, saying, quote, competitions are for horses, not artists.
Bartok.
No way. Laurel, did you get your mean before Ben?
She did. That was, yeah, I did know that one.
Oh, okay. Sometimes that's why it's speed trivia. Yeah, so that was one of the comments. Actually, we learned that little Bartok quote because Gordon Stout submitted a question regarding competition, said, what do you guys think about this quote about competitions from Bartok? So, yeah, another little quote from behavioral psychologist Alfie Cohn from one of his books. Precisely because we are so immersed in it, competition can easily escape our notice. A fish does not reflect on the nature of water. Walkie Percy once remarked, he cannot imagine its absence, so he cannot consider its presence. I thought that was kind of cool, just like competition is everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. Yeah, okay, moving on. Okay, this new piece of legislation passed and signed into law literally just a few weeks ago on August 11th. It will streamline and simplify the payout process for songwriters and composers. This is designed to allow for composers to be paid according to what they're calling fair market value, rather than the fractions upon fractions of cents, such as the example we use, 70 million digital streams paying out only $1,000. This legislation is called what?
The Music Modernization Act.
Oh my gosh, Laurel again. Ben.
I knew it. She just got the me in first. I was the one that sent everyone that article.
You did.
That's right. It was initially your idea. That's right. It took me forever to really get the meat and potatoes out of that legislation. It's just like way, way complicated. But anyway, so this one, Ben reported way back on episode 7, this composer wrote concertos for what he considered to be neglected instruments in the literature, such as accordion, saxophone, harp, trombone, and also one for us, which was written for Ruth Stuber and the all-female orchestra in New York called the Orchestrette Classique. This composer has two names. What are they?
Ooh, Paul Creston.
Right.
And his Italian name, which right. There's a G involved, I think.
That's right.
I just looked it up on Wikipedia. I'm not going to lie. Giuseppe Gudaveggio.
I think you can have
But
it.
Who yeah, would have gotten right. that?
Yeah. Yeah. Say it one more time for us.
Giuseppe Gudaveggio.
Yeah, Giuseppe Gudaveggio. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and this was your reporting on this. I wouldn't know any of this if it wasn't for you. So yeah, you certainly get that. Cool. Well, yeah, guys, okay, that is the quiz. Laurel is still in the lead, and Ben is catching up a little bit. So, Ben, I think we have
courtesy
at least one more
Wikipedia.
Question for Mr. Van Sice, right?
So I had a question, actually, for Bob that I wanted to ask about, because when I was 15 years old, I got a job working at an ice cream store, and I saved up literally every penny I made there. And about a year later, I was able to purchase my first marimba, which was an Adams Robert Van Sice classic artist model. And so I was wondering if we could ask Mr. Van Sice about developing that instrument, and I guess to go along with that, developing your signature mallet with Vic Firth.
Okay. This has been really one of the joys of my whole career. I believe so much in timbre, and you know, it's this. I can even start by my answer by the fact that isn't this exciting that at PASIC we're going to see Rich Wiener go into the Hall of Fame, and you know that that man and Cloyd Duff were so much of my education about sound, sitting in the balcony of Severance Hall for 4 years during my education, and care to sound and how important great sound is in our art form. And that was really sort of the very base of it. And then when I went to Japan, there was a magical man by the name of Suzuki who was doing all the designing of instruments for Yamaha, made that glorious marimba and all those beautiful mallets for Keiko. And this really piqued my interest in seeing if I could put my hand into helping players develop their sound with the tools of their trade. And so the beginnings of the instrument with Adams, I had any number of sessions until all hours of the night in the factory in Thorn, the little tiny town in Holland where Adams is located, with Andre Adams, who is now retired himself, and his son-in-law, Franz Swinkels, who runs the company today. That was some of the greatest fun and some of the most important things that I think that I ever did in my percussion career. With a man, Mr. Adams had ears that were just almost scary of what he could hear in overtones and in tunings and et cetera, et cetera. And just to be able to, as a player, describe to these two men who could make anything what I was looking for in the sound of a marimba that I hadn't quite found yet. And to be able to really be involved in that great trial and error process that used to happen week after week after week, going back to the factory until we finally got our very first instrument. And that process hasn't stopped in one single bit in the 22 years that we've had our relationship. And those marimbas get better and better and better and better and better, and they're never satisfied with where they're at. And as I tell people too, I'm really kind of a bad sort of poster child for a brand of marimba, because I'm not one of these guys who says everybody else's marimba is awful, so you should buy mine.
Actually, if I could add to that, one of the funniest things I've ever seen is at the University of Illinois, they had all the old percussive notes back issues sitting around. And I opened one up to an ad for Concord marimbas, and there it is, Robert Van Sice. This is the last marimba I will ever play.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's with making of instruments and making of mallets, we're in such a good place. Ron Samuels is building these gorgeous marimbas. Lee builds beautiful marimbas. Yamaha's making gorgeous instruments. I mean, we have just all these people, and we're in the same luxury now. My father was a French horn player. And you played a Paxman or an Alexander or a Con 80 or whatever you played, just simply depending upon what sound was in your ear and what your own physiology was that would make certain instruments work better than others. And we're not in this place anymore to where there are two decent marimbas. A lot of people have figured out an awful lot about how to make instruments. We have a very specific vision of a marimba, for better or for worse. It's what's in my ear. A lot of it is designed around the sound of an Amati violin. This is a specific maker of violins that I'm very fond of. And it's a little bit European and a little bit American as a sound, if you will. I tried to take the things that the Cleveland sounds that were in my ear and the Concertgebouw sounds that were in my ear and try to merge them into a marimba. And then with the making of mallets, that was a tremendous part of my life. That first part of that venture, my wife and I owned that company together. Cecile wrapped every single one of those mallets herself by hand until 3 a.m, until finally when I came to Adams and began to design their instruments and work with them, it just had become impossible for Cecile to keep up with the amount of orders. The Adams folks bought that business and now manufacture all the mallets are made in the factory in Holland. And we've been able to be on the outside designing and just tweaking those things. So yeah, man, the making of my marimba and the making of mallets, it's been one of the great joys. And once in a while when I hear somebody who I just think, wow, that just sounds great. And that number 124 mallet is really making the top of time for marimba really sing for him or her. It's just really joyous to think, wow, you know, some implement that we spent 1,000,000 hours going through cores and wrapping and yarns and blah, 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 is in the end making somebody be able to express themselves. And it's an exciting part of my career, and it's probably something I'll never give up.
You mean, Betty?
Sorry, the Vic Firth mallets are actually made by Adams in Holland.
Yeah, all the mallets with my name on them are actually manufactured in Holland, and the Firth guys are a distributor in North America, and that's been a sensational relationship. That's a great company. I was taken care of by some really wonderful people over the years at Vic Firth who really believe in that product and who really believe in percussion in general. I mean, look at the amazing website and what all those great performances have done for so many young people who've seen so many great performances over the years and can study them. And it's like the sort of genius of Khan Academy, if any of you, well, your case, you guys are brand new parents, but the Khan Academy magic that you can watch that calculus problem 17 times until you actually get it.
Right.
And if you're a young guy and you're in a place and you're learning threads and maybe you don't have all the guidance you might wish you had, well, here's a really terrific performance. All you have to do is open up your laptop and watch it over and over again. And we all know as percussionists, it makes all the difference in the world. You go, oh my gosh, you put that conga on the left side right under the cymbal. Oh wow, that's way easier. That sounds better. And that all of those bits and pieces, that website and what we did with all of that has very little to do with star making. It's not about making sure that, you know, every kid all over the world sees Ji Soo Jung play the marimba. I mean, that's a nice side effect. But it's about bringing the Klatso marimba etudes to somebody who might not know about their existence in really great performances that they can watch over and over and over and take stickings from and watch body positions and look at stroke heights. I mean, and so that's just been an incredibly fruitful relationship that I've had with the Firth people. But they don't actually manufacture those mallets. They distribute them in North America.
Well, gotcha. I think you have something to get us towards.
I did. It's a very, very fast little tidbit because our son might wake up any moment now. But I guess it was about 12 years ago, 13 years ago, Mr. Manslice, that you went to the University of Tennessee for a master class. And I don't know if you remember doing that, but there was a girl that played for you, and that was me.
Oh, my God. Did I behave myself while you were playing? I hope so.
You did, yeah. I don't expect you to remember, but I remember, like, that was the first time I'd ever played in a master class from anybody, and I had your mallets, and I was, like, so nervous.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it was very fun. And we played wooden music. I think I learned one of the parts, and you played one of the other parts. Oh,
I do remember this. In fact, I do this quite often now, whether it's that or Minori's piece or any of the duo pieces. I love to take them around and play. Oh, I think you're making me blush. It's a good thing that we don't have this on video because we've had so many great experiences with Estudios de Frontera when Alejandro wrote that piece. Its title is what it is. It's about sort of cutting edge teaching. And it gave me a platform that when I went and traveled that I could play with people instead of just, you know, sit in a chair with your mallets there and demonstrate five bars here and there and, you know, do a bunch of highfalutin talking. You learn a million times more from playing with somebody. And I had magnificent lessons with Mrs. Abe when I lived in Japan, but nothing compared to when she and I played some duo pieces together in a little concert in Tokyo one night. And I'll never forget that. And the chance to just make music back and forth. Well, my gosh, I hope that I behaved myself during the whole masterclass. Didn't say anything off color or God knows what, but every time I give a masterclass, my son used to travel with us all the time. He said, Dad, okay, let's just go over this one more time. We do this every time you do a masterclass. Two rules. Don't sing, because whenever you sing a phrase to them, you're singing so bad, they all make fun of you behind your back and you can't see that. Okay. And above all, don't do that weird dancing thing that you do all the time when people are playing to you, because they make way more fun of you when you dance. But it's like the only two ways that I know how to teach is from singing and moving my body. So what can I tell you? But oh my gosh, that's a long time ago. And it's been such a pleasure to be back home. You know, I loved my time living in Europe, and it was something I wouldn't trade for the world. But it has felt so good for the last two decades to be back home where I was raised and to share with people who, you know, grew up where I did the things that I had the privilege of learning both in Asia and in Europe, and bring those things back home. Let's hope that home can stay sane.
Yes.
Before we were starting, we were talking a little bit about how the internet has changed education. And yes. I remember I cut you off because I said, we got to record this. What you're saying is just so, so good. And I wish we could just jump right back into where we were. Can you talk a little bit about how, maybe in terms of some advice for mid-career folks like Ben, Laurel, and I, who are going to be continuing at universities, and you were just talking about how much things have changed.
The department chair especially, yeah.
Well, listen, for the better and for the worse, I think that the democratization of information is truly beautiful. The fact that now information is available to everybody is something that appeals to my sensibilities of society. The one small worry that I have, well, what we were talking about earlier, I'll just kind of recap really quickly, is that those of us who teach in universities, whether you teach chemistry, English literature, or percussion, there's a very cute little baby coming on screen. That's nice. Hi, big guy.
That's Robin.
How are you? Nice to meet you, even if it's only over the computer. How are you?
He's been meeting some famous people lately. He had a beer with Libby Larson just a few nights ago.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. There you go. Living large.
Hello.
To finish my answer to you, Casey, I think that when universities used to sort of be known as the towers within which knowledge was kept. If you wanted that knowledge, you needed to come to us to get it. Well, now that knowledge sits on your laptop and then your phone. And so facts are no longer the reason that anyone comes to be educated. And now we need to redefine what our mission is. And how do we teach people how to use knowledge? And how do we teach people how to put pieces of knowledge together into thoughts? And more than anything, how do we teach people how to teach themselves? And it's a very fascinating time to where education is going to change radically because of this. There's one sort of anecdote that I'll be very short with, but you brought up Mrs. Abe before, and when I was first learning about Japanese marimba music, that's thanks to a magical man by the name of Michael Rosen, who introduced me to this music and to Keiko Abe. And I first learned about this music from Mike, about Mrs. Abe, et cetera, from Mike Rosen. And I was dead curious and fascinated, to say the very least. But at that time, Casey, and please, I'm going to embarrass myself by even saying this, I had to write a letter to the cultural attaché of the Japanese consulate in New York City to find out information about Minoru Miki.
Yeah.
Now, I just dated myself as like a dinosaur by telling you. But my friend, when that information came back, it was precious.
Right.
And I can guarantee you, I learned it and it never left.
Mm-hmm.
The danger of information being so immediate and easy to garner is that you don't cherish it. And then as a result, you don't keep it as deeply as those of us who had to work. And I mean, nothing's worse. Come on, Casey. We all hate the I had to trek 5 miles in the snow in bare feet to go to elementary school nonsense. I mean, nobody wants to hear those kinds of stories. Mm-hmm. But when we really did have to work very hard to get knowledge, it was precious when it came. And I'm just a little bit worried that when all you have to do is flash your thumb across your telephone for a couple seconds to find out what it is that you're looking for about Minoru Miki, that it doesn't sit in a place in your psyche that is very precious. And I think that those young people in your generation who've got the privilege of growing up in that time just need to begin to reconcile what to do with that. Because that's a brand new phenomenon, Casey, for humanity in general. That detailed information is easily accessible.
Yeah.
But that, you know, it doesn't make it any less precious when you get it. And then the question is, once you get that information, how will you use it?
Right.
And I always say to my students, and you know, you've mentioned any number of these marvelous people that I've had the privilege of teaching in my life, but that my idea of good teaching is that I little bit by little bit work myself out of a job. that little bit by little bit, I teach you how I came to these conclusions so you can begin to come to yours. And there's nothing worse than cloning people and calling it teaching. If I'm sitting on a jury and within the first 30 bars, I can say, oh, this person studies with X or that person studies with Y, that means there wasn't really teaching going on there. And to teach people how to not need their guide any longer is really the essence of, I think, what it means to teach somebody. And how does that then reconcile with what the internet is and how that information comes? People smarter than me will figure this out. It's a new dynamic, that's for sure.
Wow, fantastic. Well, you guys, thanks so much for joining me on episode 167, Ben, Laurel, and man, Robert Van Sice. This was so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I felt like I got to come over to your house for an hour. It's a nice feeling, get to even see your baby and the whole thing. That's couldn't be better. And peace be with you, my friend.
Yes, and you too. Hey, thank you, everyone. We'll catch you on the next episode, which by my count, my look at the schedule, is Colin Curry. So see
you. Oh, that's really good stuff.
I know. We've got this luck streak right now. It's just really, really, really good. So, okay, everybody, take it easy. We'll catch you next time.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye-bye.